Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
That is unreal, and I am so happy.
That's the sound of Teresa getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be stocking her school library with new books. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2023 Accord. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you, and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 6th of June, these are our main stories. There is severe flooding in parts of southern Ukraine after the destruction of a major dam. Prince Harry is in court alleging journalists illegally gathered information about him. And the Brazilian singer Astrid Gilberto, who brought bossa nova to the world with her version of The Girl from Ipanema, has died at the age of 83. Also in this podcast, the end of an era in Singapore.
Gates are back and they're racing in the cup. Mingzi Cosmos, one of the best to begin. Peranda out wide, showing some speed and some are surprised.
Why, the days are numbered for the country's last horse racing track. We start in Ukraine, where Kyiv has accused Russia of blowing up a crucial dam on the Dnipro River to hamper its military offensive in the south. Pictures show a huge torrent of water rushing down from what in places is a body of water tens of kilometres wide, destroying what's left of the dam as it passes. As we record this podcast, President Zelensky said 80 towns and settlements were at risk of flooding after the destruction of the dam at Nova Kakhova. Evacuations are underway. James Waterhouse is in Kyiv.
According to Ukrainian officials, water levels will reach a critical level in the next couple of hours. Now, we know they are evacuating thousands of people from settlements right along the river towards the southern city of Kherson, but only on the western bank of the river, which it controls, because this is also a front line. On the eastern bank, that is land occupied by Russia, which controls the Kakhovka Dam. They were accused of laying it with explosives last year, which it denied, and Kyiv once again blames Moscow for being responsible for the scenes we are seeing. Now, we can't definitively say who is responsible, but in a military sense, it computes more for Russia to have carried this out. Why? Well, Ukraine is starting its counter-offensive step by step, and this is an area which Russian forces have been preparing for some kind of Ukrainian offensive. Blowing this dam up takes out a major crossing point and it also widens the river itself. But the collateral damage is huge. People in occupied Crimea to the south have also been cut off from water supplies or in danger of being cut off. And then you have the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant upstream, also controlled by Russian forces, which rely on the river's water to cool its six reactors. So the collateral damage is vast. But nevertheless, this is connected to the early stages of Ukraine's much-anticipated counteroffensive.
Russia insists that Ukraine is responsible. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, accused Kyiv of sabotage.
We can state unequivocally that we are talking about a deliberate sabotage of the Kakhovka Dam by the Ukrainian side. This sabotage has potentially very serious consequences for several tens of thousands of residents of the region, as well as ecological consequences.
Whoever was responsible, our correspondent Vitaly Shevchenko says the damage is huge and getting worse.
What I'm seeing is truly apocalyptic. Things like whole houses floating down the Dnieper, swans swimming around the central square of Nova Kakhovka, the town where the dam was, and all sorts of really serious issues can arise both upstream and downstream from the dam. The immediate danger for the people downstream is really serious, and Ukrainian officials say about 16,000 people are at risk. They're carrying out evacuations by bus and by train to the neighbouring big Ukrainian-controlled city of Mykolaiv. But upstream, we're talking about a huge body of water, the Kakhovka Reservoir, which is so big that locally it's known as the Kakhovka Sea. If you stand on one bank of it, in certain places you wouldn't be able to see the other bank. It's beyond the horizon. It's so big.
And obviously the situation is worrying people. It could cause a loss of life. But in terms of the position militarily, what impact could it have on Ukraine's ability to do this counter-offensive?
Well, to start with, the dam was a handy crossing point. It's not there anymore. If you try and cross the Dnieper, which is Ukraine's biggest, widest, longest river, it's become even wider. It's swamped downstream. It's more difficult for you. But I'm also seeing reports of Russian defensive positions on the southeastern bank of the river that they control. Some of those have been flooded too. Mm-hmm. Now, the long-term effect on people upstream can be really serious because we're talking about whole communities, tens of thousands of people, who for generations have relied on water from this reservoir or this sea for farming, both farmers and local residents who harvested their own fruit and veg. If water levels recede far enough, they will just not have enough water to survive this very hot and dry summer.
Vitaly Shevchenko there. Well, the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, said destroying civilian infrastructure clearly qualified as a war crime. Around 80% of all the heroin sold around the world used to be made from opium grown in Afghanistan. But now a BBC investigation suggests the country's Taliban government has successfully enforced a ban on the cultivation of opium poppies. Expert analysis of high-resolution satellite images shows there's been a dramatic fall in Afghan opium farming compared with last year. Our South Asia correspondent Yogita Limai has also been to see whether those images match the reality, starting in the eastern province of Nangarhar.
This is a Taliban anti-narcotics patrol unit. They're on their way, walking through farms and fields, and we've been walking with them,
trying to find fields of poppy to destroy them.
One of the fields belonged to farmer Ali Muhammad Mia. I asked him why he grew poppy despite the ban.
If you don't have enough food in your house and your children are going hungry, what else will you do? If we grew wheat instead, we won't earn enough to survive.
We've been driving through the provinces of both Helmand and Kandahar. We were here last year, and last year when we looked out of the car window, wherever we went, pretty much what we saw in most places was poppy being grown in the fields. This time around, we've been able to spot wheat, we've been able to spot grapes, lots and lots of barren land, but I haven't seen a single poppy field. What we saw is also backed by the findings of ALSIS, a British firm specialising in satellite analysis, working together with David Mansfield, a leading expert on Afghanistan's drugs trade, who spoke to us from the UK.
Poppy cultivation has fallen dramatically in 2023, and while the poppy season is not yet complete, it is likely that cultivation will be less than 20% of what it was in 2022. The scale of the reduction will be unprecedented. The high-resolution imagery of Helmand, a province that typically produces more than 50% of Afghanistan's production, is basically down to less than 1,000 hectares when it was 129,000 hectares the previous year.
I'm in a field in Helmand in the southwest of Afghanistan where there's wheat growing. Niamatullah, the farmer who owns this piece of land, told us that up until last year he used to grow poppy here.
We are very upset. Wheat earns us a fraction of what we used to make from opium. We can't meet our family's needs. I've had to take a loan. Hunger is at its peak and we haven't got any help from the government.
We met the main spokesman of the Taliban government, Zabiullah Mujahid, who told us they banned opium because it's harmful and goes against their religious beliefs.
Farmers say they're not getting any support from your government. How do you plan to help them?
We know that people are very poor, but opium causes a lot of addiction. We call on international organizations to help Afghans facing losses. They should not link humanitarian issues with political matters. Opium isn't just harming Afghanistan. The whole world is affected by it.
He rejected UN and US assertions that the Taliban profited from opium when they were fighting against foreign forces and the former Afghan regime. For now, his government appears to have accomplished what no one else could. But there are questions about how long they can sustain it.
Yogita Limai reporting. Prince Harry has been giving evidence against the owners of a British newspaper group in the High Court in London. Vile, twisted and hostile, just some of the words he used to describe the behaviour of journalists that he alleges used illegal methods like phone hacking to gather information about him. Harry is the first British royal to testify in court since the 19th century. In 1891, the royal was Edward, Prince of Wales, the son of Queen Victoria and future Edward VII. He'd played a game of baccarat, in which one of the other players was said to be cheating, and he gave evidence at the High Court. We asked the actor Jos Van Tyler to read us a newspaper's account of what happened there in 1891.
The prince gave his evidence in a halting, hesitating manner, and he seemed to be very glad and exceedingly relieved when his examination was over. Though it only lasted 20 minutes, the examination of the prince evidently wearied him exceedingly and made him extremely nervous. He did not seem able to make himself at ease on the stand. It was noticed that the heir apparent was decidedly fidgety, that he kept changing his position and did not seem able to keep his hands still. The prince repeatedly smoothed his beard with his right hand, never once lifted his eyes to the people in the courtroom, except to the Lord Chief Justice, counsel, jurors, press representatives, and others in proximity to the witness box. Only a couple of the prince's answers were fairly audible throughout the court. When a question more pressing, more to the point than usual, was put to him, the prince's face was observed to flush considerably, and then pale again, showing the state of nervousness in which he found himself.
That was Jos Van Tyler reading an article in the Boston Daily Globe. So, back to today. Prince Harry entered the witness box and has also submitted a lengthy written statement. Our correspondent Helena Wilkinson is at the court and told us what we've heard from the prince so far.
Prince Harry entered the witness box at 10:30, so he was cross-examined for over 2.5 hours or so. But also, as you mentioned, we got that written statement, which we have had sight of. And just to bring you some of the headlines from that, and from the statement and also his evidence so far, we've heard about the distress, the paranoia that articles, tabloid newspaper articles that were written about Prince Harry from when he was very young, have had on his life and continue to have on his life. So in the witness statement, he says that tabloids hacked his voicemail when he was a teenager at Eton College. So when he was a young boy, his allegation is that that is when the phone hacking began. Important to point out at this stage that the publisher denies that any phone hacking took place in Prince Harry's case. Prince Harry also said that his voicemails would include incredibly private and sensitive information. And he talked about very specific cases, one when he was with his on-off girlfriend relationship with somebody called Chelsea Davy. He remembers arriving at an airport and there being a number of big, burly men there, which he says were paid for. His allegation was that they were paid for by the newspapers, and that's how they got information. Private investigators were used to find out, he says, where Prince Harry was. He also says the paper's behaviour, and this is his word that he used, was vile and had him in a downward spiral. He talked about how he moved to the United States with his family. Not only the newspaper reporting about his life created security concerns, he says, but also had damaged his personal relationships as well. So he is continuing to be questioned here, cross-examined by the barrister for the opposing party, that's the publishers, and it is a tough environment for Prince Harry to be in, to face those very open, tough questions, nothing like what he will have experienced before, and yet more cross-examination will take place.
Helena Wilkinson. Hong Kong's government has applied for a court injunction against a protest song that's often mistaken for the territory's national anthem. The tune, Glory to Hong Kong, was written during protests 4 years ago and has become associated with the pro-democracy movement. On occasions, it's even been played in error instead of China's national anthem, to the annoyance of government officials. Michael Bristow reports.
The tune, Glory to Hong Kong, was written during protests 4 years ago and has become associated with the pro-democracy movement. The authorities believe it incites subversion. The injunction would even make it illegal for it to be available on the internet, where it often pops up for anyone typing in the phrase Hong Kong Anthem. That search result has occasionally led to the protest song being played in error at sporting events instead of this tune. This is China's national anthem, the March of the Volunteers, the official song to represent the territory. Glory to Hong Kong is already effectively banned in the former British colony. By applying for this injunction, the authorities want to close every loophole to prevent it being heard. This legal action shows the power of music to rally protesters, the alarm one song can instill in Chinese officials, and just how much free speech has been curtailed in Hong Kong.
Michael Bristow. Coming up in this podcast, trained in Africa, caring for patients in the UK, why the medical brain drain goes on and on.
The exodus of nurses is not going to stop because of our poor condition of service. It's from hand to mouth.
After the horrific train accident in India's Balasore district in Odisha state that left more than 275 people dead, many families are struggling to find their loved ones. The BBC's Vinit Kare has been to the place where bodies are being kept after morgues ran out of space.
Seema is looking for a husband who was in the horrific train accident in Odisha. Many, like Seema, are still searching for their loved ones among the dead.
This is a business park in Balasore. This is a place where bodies of most of the victims had been brought so that the relatives who are coming from long distances could come here and identify their loved ones.
Pictures of the dead are being projected on a screen on the other side of the hall. Some more photographs are kept on a desk nearby to help with the identification process. Sumit Kumar is looking for his aunt's son, Neeraj Kumar.
We haven't found his body, but I found a photograph of him here. So I physically checked about 200 to 250 corpses, but I haven't found anything yet.
Subrat Mukhi has been helping people move the dead into ambulances and cars for many hours now.
I've been working since 8 p.m. last night. It's hard. Even we can't help crying. The relatives of the victims have been coming here from all over. They've been talking to us in Odia, Bangla and Tamil. They're trying to communicate with us as best as they can.
Everyone here, including people, NGOs and government officials, is busy helping in whichever way possible. But the process has been difficult given the scale of the disaster.
Vinit Kare. Russia has been condemned by the European Court of Human Rights for failing to properly investigate the poisoning of Alexei Navalny. The Russian dissident almost died during an internal flight in 2020 after being exposed to the nerve agent Novichok. Alexei Navalny is currently serving an 11-and-a-half-year jail sentence for fraud and contempt of court, charges he says were politically motivated. As we record this podcast, he faces further charges later today, including that he set up an extremist organisation. Navalny's spokesperson is Kira Yamish.
Today he will be present during this preliminary hearing. His spirit doesn't correlate with his conditions. I mean, he believes in what he is doing and it keeps him going on. He's not only in a jail cell, he's in a punishment cell in total isolation. There is no hot water there. There is no ventilation. Your bed is fastened to the wall during the daytime, so you are forbidden to lay down. You don't have any time for exercise, and your cell is 6 square meters, so it is almost impossible to move there properly. So his health is not very well, of course. I am completely sure that they will close the whole case, and Alexei is facing up to 30 more years in prison in the end of this trial. And I am sure that they will give him, I don't know, something like this amount. The whole case is fabricated, and there are no proofs in case materials. And this is why they're trying to make it so secret.
That was Kira Yamish. The BBC has uncovered evidence that Ghana's healthcare system is being crippled by staff shortages due to recruitment of nurses overseas. The International Council of Nurses says the recruitments are out of control. An analysis of the latest data shows more than 1,200 Ghanaians joined the UK's nursing register last year. That's twice the number joining from the whole of the European Union. Our global health correspondent Naomi Grimley reports.
Everyone's working hard in intensive care at this big hospital in Accra. But there's a problem. The head of nursing, Gifty Ari, tells me the hospital has lost more than 20 intensive care nurses in the last 6 months. And that doesn't include midwives or general nurses. It's had a serious impact on the ward.
Patients are seriously ill and it causes more mortality. Patients die.
In theatre recovery, a nurse called Yar is on a break, watching a video about work overseas.
So, you are a level 3 RN, but your payslip you are sharing now is a level 2 RN.
Yar, what was that video about?
Two nurses comparing their salaries. One is in the USA, one is in the UK. The one in the US takes much more than the one in the UK.
Still tempted to go?
Of course. If you should get me an opportunity, my passport, everything is ready. Just, oh yeah, let's go. I'll just take my bag and join you in a jiffy.
But for hospitals in remote areas, the effects of brain drain are much more serious. Ghana's current economic problems add a huge push factor for those nurses wanting to earn more. In the vaccination clinic amid mothers and babies, I meet Mercy, who wants a new life in Britain.
The exodus of nurses is not going to stop because of our poor condition of service. Like, our salary is nothing to write home. Within 2 weeks, you spend it. It's from hand to mouth.
In Cape Coast, on Ghana's southern flank, idyllic beaches and colourful markets disguise the fact that this is one of the country's most deprived regions. The main hospital here complains it has lost 22 nurses to the UK. Caroline Arboja is deputy head of nursing services.
All our critical care nurses, our experienced nurses, are all gone today. So virtually, we end up having nothing, no experienced staff to work with. If even the government recruits, we have to go through the pain of training them again.
One of the area's doctors, Justice Arthur, doesn't hold back on his assessment of what this means for patients.
The impact is enormous. Let's take services like immunization of children. If we lose public health nurses, then the babies that have to be immunized will not get the required immunization, and we are going to have babies die.
This continent is used to outsiders wanting its precious resources. And today, the most precious resource of all is nurses.
Naomi Grimley reporting. Now to Singapore.
Back and they're racing in the Cup. Mingzi Cosmos, one of the best to begin. Peranda out wide, showing some speed, and Summer Surprise will zoom through on the inside.
That is a sound that will soon be a thing of the past, because after more than 180 years, horse racing is coming to an end in Singapore. It's just been announced that the nation's only racecourse, the Singapore Turf Club, will hold its final meeting next year. Our correspondent there, Katie Silver, told me more.
It's quite an incredible piece of history. They say, for example, it's long and distinguished. It was founded by a Scotsman, a man by the name of William Henry MacLeod Reid. He was a part of the, had a merchant trader. During its time in the 180 years, it's changed locations a few times. It started out relatively central, but then it was increasingly popular amongst both Europeans as well as wealthy Malay and Chinese racegoers. It then moved to a larger location a little bit further out. And then once again, back in 2000, it moved even further out again. Now it's in an area called Kranji, which is on the border of Malaysia, and it has indeed been a site of history. To give you an idea, for example, during the Japanese occupation in World War II, the track was actually used to grow fruit trees in order to feed the soldiers and the population. We saw Queen Elizabeth II visit twice. In fact, there's even a race that's named after her. Even just a short time ago, in terms of modern history, during the time of COVID, we saw the migrant workers who were living in dormitories actually being housed at the racetrack. So it well and truly has had a long history, but with fewer people going and the popularity of it decreasing, it's seen really as important now to pivot towards using it primarily for housing, because Singapore has such a small land area to work with.
So you talked a lot about the history of it. How much of a loss for people in Singapore will it be?
The truth is that in recent times, fewer people have been going, and Singaporean friends I've spoken with see it really as a bit of a relic of a colonial era. I don't know of people really that go there very often to watch the races. And the country is so small. It's a small island, a very limited landmass. And given the issues when it comes to density here, I think many people feel that it could perhaps be better employed. To give you an idea about how dense Singapore is, it's the third most dense country in the world, just behind Macau and Monaco. It's about half the size of London, but it's got 5 million people, and that creates issues when it comes to food security, deforestation, also just huge housing shortages. In recent times, we've seen the rents absolutely skyrocketed, as well as the price for public housing, which is what about 80% of Singaporeans live in. So I do feel that in general, you know, there's a lot of mystique and excitement around it when we read about the history of it. But amongst, as I say, the Singaporeans I speak with, they do feel that the land could be better used to solve some of these more modern day issues.
That was Katie Silver. The Brazilian singer Astrud Gilberto, the voice of the bossa nova classic The Girl from Ipanema, has died. She was 83. Her rendition of that famous song in 1963 made her an international superstar and won her a Grammy. Despite the song's success, though, Gilberto wasn't credited on the record, and according to some, may not even have been paid for her performance. Peter Hyatt looks back at her life and work.
It was in a New York recording studio in March 1963 that a young woman who'd rarely performed in public was invited to sing one verse in English on a song which the jazz saxophone player Stan Getz and the Brazilian singer-guitarist João Gilberto were recording together. The young woman was João's wife Astrud, and the song went on to change all their lives.
Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking, and when she passes, each one she passes goes ah.
The Girl from Ipanema sent a shockwave of bossa nova around the world and made Astrud, with her cool charm and apparently artless delivery, into an instant star. Born 23 years earlier into a musical family in Brazil, she'd married the difficult musical genius João 4 years before that fateful day in New York. A string of hits followed, including the delightful one-note samba.
As I'm bound to be the unavoidable consequence of you.
But the marriage to João didn't last much longer. She later formed a personal as well as professional relationship with Stan Getz, which also failed in the end. In later years, Astrud Gilberto made music and toured with groups which included her grown-up children. There was also a remarkable collaboration with the British musician George Michael. As the years went by, she withdrew more and more from the limelight, concentrating instead on animal welfare and on her painting. In 2002, she said she was taking indefinite leave from public performances, a typically delicate end to a career which had combined the appearance of cool detachment with real emotion.
If you're smart, really smart.
That was Peter Hyatt reporting. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Never Miss Syrian, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
Money laundering operations.
A cyber criminal group.
These are smart guys.
Seasons 1 and 2 of The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service are available in full right now.
Following the twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist from the BBC World Service. Catch up with the whole series now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Thank you. Oh my goodness, I'm so happy. You came through.
That's the sound of Kim getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be paying for her dog's much-needed MRI. And we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2023 CR-V. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.